You would take your Bibles out, put your bookmark in Matthew chapter 16. We're not going to start there, but that's where we will spend a good bit of our time here in a few minutes, and so that's as good a place as any to mark, because we will get there. We were singing the last song. Heard several of the speakers this week talk about having to speak in front of Dad, and I understand that. That doesn't give me as much pause, however. When during the last song, Buddy Payne walks in and sits down, Mr. Payne nearly kicked me out of Florida College. And, man, I just had flashbacks that that are very unsettling. And so, thanks so much. mercy. Early in the week, I think it was Monday, Bubba got up and made the point that generally the Southside lectures kind of build to a crescendo as the week goes along. And then he said, but not this week. And I thought, okay. Dad, our job is to bring the lectures in with a whimper. And so go get them, okay? I would be amiss, like everyone else, and I will do the best to do this as briefly as I can. I would be amiss if I did not express my gratitude to this church. I have tried a number of times through the years to tell you how much you mean to me, and I don't know. I don't have the words to express that. All these other guys were here for a couple of years. This in many ways is home, and you are home. And I appreciate you. I love you. So many of you I grew up with, and it's so encouraging. And I've said this before. Maybe there's some young people here that haven't heard it. It is very encouraging to see the people you grew up with still faithful to the Lord. And I really hope all you guys that are over here in 40 years, because that's how long it's been, believe it or not, can look back and look across the pew in a church building somewhere and see the same bunch of folks that are still serving the Lord. And that is most encouraging, because I know way too many people anymore who aren't. And so thank you for your example, for all the things that you've done, for the elders and the good work that you have done, for Dad and Bubba, the good work that y'all continue to do. I am indebted, like everyone else here, and I could go on and on, but I will leave it at that. Thank you, and I love you, and I'm always honored to be asked to come speak here. Good to be with Tim. I appreciate so much your work. I appreciated your father before you. Appreciate you. It makes a huge difference when you are trying to preach and you're having a song service to have someone that leads with enthusiasm and with passion and with meaning, with the spirit and the understanding. So thank you for the work you have done this week. And then to all these other guys that we share, we share a fraternity. It has been very apparent this week. This has been, in many ways, a very emotional week for me. I'm getting to the age where that's more common. My kids are growing up. My last one just graduated. Haley's about to hopefully leave home and go get a job. And so, you know, we're going through that. The nest is emptying, and everybody rejoices in that, tells me how much fun it's going to be. Not yet. It's not. I love my kids, and so that's hard. Being with Dad, we've gotten to work together three times this year. And I don't know how many occasions we'll have to speak the same night. Those are few and far between. So that is emotional. And then there's just a lot of stuff going on in life, in some of your lives and in my life. And so it's been a very emotional week, and I feel that with regards to these guys. It has been fun to sit there and listen to them talk about my dad. You know, it's different for me to hear all these guys talk about Brother D and the PhD and all that good stuff and all the good things that he has done for them and said to them. And are you about to die? I have have for years wondered, you know, when Dad passes away, what are we going to say? I'm just bringing the tapes from this week, going to plug them in. Oh. But I appreciate the things you've said about him. There won't be any living with him, but I appreciate the things that you said about him. I appreciate all you guys. I've had a lot of privileges in the preacher training program. I've been in it for 56 years, Bubba. So what was it that David said? Dude, you know? I got to hear what Dad thought about all you guys. And I'm not kidding. And some of you said, Brother D, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be preaching. And you don't know the half of it. So that's been fun this week. But I'm going to tell you guys, and I want the rest of you to know about these other guys. I mean, they're great talent, all the things that have been said about them. I'm going to tell you what I admire about these other guys. After this week, when you have a bunch of folks here and the singing is great and everybody's enthusiastic and everybody's here because they want to hear the word, all these guys are going to go home. And some of them are going to go back to big churches and some are going to go back to little churches, and they're all going to go back to their local work. And local works work. And they're going to go back to the problems, and they're going to go back to the frustrations, and they're going to go back to try to figure out how we can get this person and that person to be more engaged, and about this guy that's not coming to services, or this woman over here that's struggling with her faith, and how are we going to do this, and how are we going to do that, and we're going to work with the elders, and we're going to work with the deacons, and we're going to go home, and we're going to wonder why in the world we're still doing this, and whether or not we even ought to be doing this, or whether it's just time to go find a ditch to dig. And that's what I admire about you guys. So thank you for working in the kingdom day in and day out when there's no big crowd, because that's the measure of preaching the gospel. And so I appreciate y'all for that, and I appreciate for the love that you have for my dad. In Proverbs, the proverbial writer, the older I get, the more I appreciate some of the Proverbs and some of the Psalms. In Proverbs chapter 17 and verse 6, the proverbial writer said, "Children's children are the crown of old men, and the glory of children is their father." And you think about that, and you think of a little kid and their dad and imitating him and dressing like him and looking like him and wanting to be like him. Nah, that's not talking about little kids. That's talking about grown men with good dads. So I thank you, and I love you, and I love you, Mom. And Jonathan, they were telling me about marriage a long time before you came along, okay? So, and by the way, one other thing. You can quit writing on the chalkboard now. They've hired you permanently, okay? You don't have to flatter Daddy anymore. All right, well, I appreciate you giving me the time to make those comments, and I will do my best to get finished on time. We've talked about a lot of things this week, and the disadvantage of speaking next to last is everybody's already covered most of your material. So I want to build on that a little bit. I want to remind you of a couple things that have been said, and they've actually been repeated as we begin this study. We are very much impacted by our culture. That point has been made over and over this week, and it's always been the case. And it's that case in a lot of ways. Whether you want to talk about the way we dress, whether you want to talk about our technology, whether you want to talk about the fads that come and go. You remember Pet Rocks? Really? Pet Rocks. You know, music, ideas, language. We're living in a culture that inundates us. And as much as we'd like to think that we're not impacted by it, we are impacted by it. And God's people have always been impacted by it. Michael talked about the children of Israel after Joshua leaving the Lord. And part of the reason they left the Lord is because they did not fulfill the commandment that God gave to them and completely destroy all the Amorites. The culture got them. Some of them may well have been instructed by their parents. We're not told that the parents failed. But what we are told is that the culture was there. And if you think about that, that's very powerful. Because while they were together as an army, they went and destroyed all the armies in the land of Canaan. But when they had to go live on their farms that they inherited, it was just them and the Canaanite next door that they were supposed to run out of the land or utterly destroy. It's hard when it's one-on-one and you got to go take care of the guy next door. And that culture influenced them. And there are a lot of areas in which that is true, and that has been addressed over and over. We've already talked about tolerance. And that's what I want to get in your mind as we begin this particular study, is the influence of a culture of tolerance. Now that's true in a lot of ways, but there are three ways in particular that I think it affects us, especially as God's people. We're encouraged, in fact, we're almost forced to tolerate immorality. We're almost forced to tolerate various religious ideas. And there is a lot of paradox in the fact that we are to tolerate religious ideas, but morality is out the window. Those things just don't go hand in hand. And then in our day and age, especially just lately, gender issues. And those things are very hot-button topics in our culture. And they are the way they are because what's happened is that we have borne the seeds that were sown 20, 30, 40 years ago. Philosophical ideas, relativism, there is no absolute truth, there is no objective truth. When that has become more and more popular in educational circles, in those who exercise influence in our society, corporate leaders, politicians, then when we have no objective truth, then what happens is we have subjective truth. And so we are in the Nike age. Just do it. Whatever you feel like doing, do. Whatever floats your boat, do. Whatever makes you feel good, do. It doesn't matter what you believe, as long as you're honest and sincere, just do what you like to do. Well, it's no surprise that we are where we are. And then you got to let the other guy do what they want to do, because the natural result of all this is a kind of an ecumenical worldview that says, you're okay and I'm okay. Those are all phrases that have been around for a long time. And they are bearing the fruit of the seeds that have been sown. And so once again, we are in the age of the judges where everyone's doing what's right in his own eyes. And I think we are rapidly, in my opinion, moving towards Romans chapter 1. Where there's just no fear of God, no one's thankful, no one feels a sense of gratitude, no one feels a sense of connection to our Creator. We look around at the world and we have come up with all kinds of ideas for creation, but we're certainly not going to claim God as Creator. And yet we're smart enough not to worship animals, but we have our idols. They look us in the mirror every day. We have made man God. And here we are. And the reason we're all worried about that is because Christianity is distinctive. When Jesus in John chapter 14 said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Some versions read true and living way, but I kind of prefer the way, the truth, and the life, because John very often in his gospel underscores Jesus as the truth. Back in chapter 1, he makes the point that the law came from Moses, but grace, as Brent's already pointed out this week, grace and truth came through Jesus. In other words, there is an objective reality. And Jesus came to express that in ways that have never been expressed before. And it is absolute. And so if we're going to be Christians, we have to accept that. Which means, no, there are not many roads to heaven. Yeah, there are many roads to Pasadena. But we ain't going to Pasadena. There's only one way to heaven. Jesus in Matthew chapter 7 describes it as a difficult way, a narrow way, and there's just going to be a few that are going on it. And he makes very bold claims of us. All authority is given to me, he tells the apostles when he's about to leave, in heaven and earth. So go make disciples and teach them to do everything I've commanded you. And that's not popular in our society. And if we're going to hold to it, we're going to be distinct. And that's what Jesus has called us to. That's what God's always called his people to. He's not called us to blend in. He didn't call the Jews to blend in. Go read the Old Testament. There's a lot of weird laws in the Old Testament. Then some of them I get, some of them I don't. I do not know I have some ideas, but I do not know for sure why you could not boil a kid in its mother's milk. But I'm going to tell you part of the reason God gave all the laws that he gave, and it's very clear in the middle section of Leviticus. When he gives a law and says, I am God, I am Yahweh, here's the law, I am Yahweh. The reason he did all that is because his people belong to him and we are different than the world. And you guys better get that in your head now. Okay? There is no blending in. And yes, it's going to get worse. And so, if you're going to obey the gospel and you're going to put him on in baptism, he is calling you to distinction. And that means conflict is inevitable for us. We're already seeing it. We're going to see it more unless things change. And that leads to the temptation. The temptation has always been compromise, acceptance, popularity, ease, numbers. If there's more of us, we feel better. We like to know. It's like David numbering the children of Israel at the end of Samuel. We want to know how many folks are on our side. Well, that is a function of the world around us. And if we can soften the message, smooth off the rough edges, make it a little more palatable to folks, a little less holiness, a little less demands, more numbers, then we feel better about ourselves. That is the temptation before us. And it's always been that way. God told Isaiah, they're going to tell you that they want you to speak smooth things to them. We've been talking about preaching this week, and I'm going to say some things at the outset to those of us who preach. The temptation is to speak smooth things, easy things. He told Ezekiel the same thing. If you tell them what I want you to tell them, they're not going to like you. They want to get together because you're a good speaker and you have a pleasant voice and he must have been a decent musician. They want the same thing from him that they want in our day and age. Give us some dramatic music, some mood lighting. Let's all raise our hands and praise the Lord and have a big old time and go home and feel good about ourselves. Our task is to uphold the truth. Every one of us. And that's what Jesus is working through with his apostles. As you study the Gospels, I don't know how much attention you've paid to that. A lot of the Gospels is really given to instructions that Jesus gives the 12. Or probably more accurately, however many real disciples there were that were following Jesus around, at least on a semi-regular basis. On one occasion, he sends out 70 of them. There's 120 of them in the beginning of Acts. And so, at various and sundry times, there are bigger numbers than the 12. But you'll notice as you read through the Gospels, very often Jesus is speaking to his disciples. And that's the point that we're going to look at this evening. If you're in Matthew chapter 16, that's where Jesus is going here in just a moment. The disciples are in a training program. The apostles. It was a 3-year program, or maybe a 2.5-year program. We don't know exactly when he called them. And they didn't get a PhD, but you'll appreciate this. They got a master's degree. And much of the caution that Jesus offers them has to do with their work, their understanding, what they're going to face. They're a bunch of common guys. It's the difference between me and Brent. You know, Brent's quoting guys that I think maybe lived, several thousand years ago. If it's not written by Louis L'Amour, not only do I not know it, I don't care what they said. So, they weren't the big educated guys with the PhDs who discussed grand ideas. They were fishermen. They worked for a living. And he was real worried about the influences upon them because they had to go teach. And so I want to make a couple of observations about a warning that Jesus gives them repeatedly. We're really going to look at two primary passages. Now, we're going to go to some other places, but we're primarily going to look at Matthew chapter 16 and Luke chapter 12. In both of those places, Jesus takes these guys, these young, energetic, enthusiastic guys who are sitting at the feet and learning about preaching. And what he tells them is, I want you to beware of the leaven. Now, let me start with this application of that warning, because I think it's implied in the warning. To those men and to us, and not only to us who preach, but to, as has been underscored to us today, about our legacy and about raising our children and about the influence that we have, to all of us who stand up as disciples of Jesus Christ who live by truth. If you continue in my words, you're truly my disciples and you'll know truth. So we're all in this together. What we teach is important. You know, we said a lot of stuff this week. But I'm going to tell you something that I want to underscore. What we teach is important. In Deuteronomy chapter 30, when Moses is about to turn the children of Israel loose to go into the promised land, he makes this statement to them in verse 19. I call heaven and earth as witnesses today against you, that I've set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life, that you and your descendants might live. Do you appreciate, folks, that that's what we're doing? We're challenging people with life or death. In fact, more than that, we're challenging people with heaven or hell. And it's a serious responsibility. Souls are in the balance. In the book of Ezekiel, in chapter 3, God told Ezekiel, I'm sending you against a hard-hearted people, and they're not going to want to listen to you, but I'm going to tell you what you better do. If you don't tell them what I want you to tell them, I'm going to require your blood, their blood, at your hand. Do you understand that responsibility? Do you appreciate how that connects to everything that we talked about this week? How important is the message? How serious we need to be about it, that the consequences are eternal. That's always interested me. We don't give a lot of attention to this. In Matthew 23, when Jesus is peeling the hide off the Pharisees about their hypocrisy, one of the things he says to them is, you hypocrites, you traverse land and sea to make one proselyte, and when you've made him, you make him twofold more the son of hell than you are. You ever wonder why the Pharisees got a little upset with Jesus? Do you appreciate if we don't preach the right thing? We're making folks sons of hell. Thought about that lately? That'll give you a little motivation on Saturday night to get your sermon up. It's a serious issue in God's eyes. If you go back to the early chapters of Deuteronomy, in chapter 13, he told the children of Israel, look, if somebody comes to you, and he's a dreamer of dreams, or he gives you a sign, and he even says, if the sign or the wonder comes to pass, and what he's telling you is to leave the Lord, what I'm telling you is don't listen to him. That's interesting to me. Add that, whoever it was that talked about Matthew chapter 7 earlier in the week, I think it was Don, about the signs and the wonders, and God saying, anyway, yeah, you did signs and wonders, but you didn't do my will. That's not a New Testament concept. God told them that in Deuteronomy. They do signs and wonders, and they come to pass. But the message leads you away from God. What he says is God's testing you, and what you need to do is kill that man. And then he goes on later in the chapter and says, if your husband or your wife or your son or your daughter or one of your close relatives tries to lead you away from God, you need to kill that person. And if there's a city that's trying to lead people away from God, you need to go kill the whole city and kill the livestock, which is interesting. I doubt very seriously the cows and the sheep and everything else had much to do with the doctrine that was going on. But God's wrath about poor teaching is that intense. And so there are warnings everywhere. We're familiar with them. We mentioned Matthew chapter 7 a moment ago, where Jesus talks about the straight and the narrow way. Do you remember what the very next thing he says there in that passage is, anybody? Beware of false prophets that come to you in sheep's clothing, who are really inside ravening wolves. You make those connections. How is it that so many people are on the big old Broadway going to destruction? Well, part of the problem is people teaching the wrong thing. And so the apostles pick up those warnings. Paul to the Ephesian elders in Acts chapter 20 actually uses the same terminology about wolves that are going to enter in and not spare the flock. Paul in Galatians chapter 1, if anybody teaches anything other than what we've taught, he is to be accursed of God. Where did Paul get that? Well, Paul was a well-educated man, and he had read Deuteronomy more than once. The warnings are everywhere. So we need to be careful what we're teaching. It wasn't that long ago that the idea of false teaching among our brethren was a hot-button topic. And those of you who are my age or older, maybe within 10 years younger, you probably remember this. And there was a lot of discussion about false teachers. You know, so-and-so's a false teacher, so-and-so. I could name names, you'd know who they are. Don't have to do that. And the discussion was often about, okay, well, just what does constitute a false teacher? And that's kind of a scary thing to me as a preacher because I've not always taught what I now believe to be the truth. I've found some old outlines, and I looked at them when I first started preaching. I've gone back and looked at them and thought, man, Dad just messed up on that one. And, you know, the reality is being a false teacher is not the same thing as someone who's learning and maturing. I mean, read Romans 14 and 15 or 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 and following, where those Jews and Gentiles are trying to deal with all of their background. And God's instruction to them is you need to be patient with one another. And, you know, some of you are going to have more education. You're going to have better understanding. You're going to be stronger. And some of you are going to be weaker. And you guys need to be patient with one another. And so I don't believe that just because you teach something wrong, and you can go ahead, if this is being crucified, publish it all over and write me up, I won't read it and I don't care. The reality is every time you teach something and make a mistake, it doesn't make you a false teacher. In 1 and 2 Timothy, the false teachers are those who are intentionally deceiving, being motivated by their own greed, being motivated by their own ego, that they are perverting the word, they're abusing the word, they know what they're doing, they're trying to put their pursue selfish ends and put themselves in a position of influence. You see the same thing in 2 Peter. Why can't we just read the scriptures and identify those are the false teachers? And there are a bunch of them out and around, and maybe some among our brethren. But I will say this about that to those of us who teach and preach, and that includes everybody in every local congregation or anybody that sits down with their neighbor and talks to them about the gospel. Even honest error is dangerous. If I make an honest mistake because I don't know as much as I need to, I could still cause somebody to lose their soul. So the admonition is we need to be careful about what we teach. We need to be studying the book. And we're not going to get the truth off the internet. We're not going to do it by downloading somebody else's sermon outline or getting their PowerPoint slides because we think that that's just a really cool subject and I'll just take that and run with it. We need to be vigilant. That's why Paul keeps telling Timothy to give attention to reading or to study to show yourself approved. He tells him about the scriptures being inspired. He tells him all the time, you need to take God's word and you need to learn it so that you can identify truth, so that you can go teach people truth. And I'm going to tell you guys, those of us who do this on a regular basis, we need to be studying because souls are at stake. And all you folks that listen to us all the time, you need to be studying too. So that when we get up and say something that's not right, we'll fall into the category in Galatians chapter 6 of the brother who needs correcting. Now, I'm going to tell you, this takes a lot of wisdom. There's a lot of conflict involved. It takes a lot of courage. But we need to be committed to making sure we're teaching the right thing because it's serious to God. Now, go to the text that we've discussed. Here's the second application I would make, and I think that's why Jesus essentially is making the point that he's making in these two passages. Because what we teach, what we do as God's people and as teachers of the gospel is crucial. Souls are at stake, and these 12 men particularly. Have you ever thought about what happened if the apostles had failed? You know, we don't think in those terms very often. What if they messed up? What if they adopted a false doctrine? What if they didn't listen to the Spirit? Well, what if their heart wasn't right and they made mistakes? I'm sure God would have, as Mordecai told Esther, God would have found someone else to rise up, but it'd be an interesting to see how he could have done that. Okay, let's get rid of these 12 and start over. He told Moses he would do that with the entire generation of Abraham's descendants, and I'm sure he could have done it, but the reality is they have a crucial job. And just like us, we're all accountable. We can't blame it on D if we mess up. Okay, guys, you know, yeah, he's been a great tutor. And he's a good and godly man, as godly as I know. But he's made some mistakes. I've called him on them over and over my whole life. But he's made some mistakes. And if we're standing before God in the day of judgment, say, but Lord, D said, that's not going to hold any water with the Lord. We're accountable. We're accountable for what we say, and we're accountable for who we follow. When the apostles are concerned that Jesus offended the Pharisees in Matthew chapter 15, you remember what he told them? They're blind leaders of the blind. And if the blind leads the blind, they're both going to fall in the ditch. You think, well, that's the leader's fault. I'm going to tell you, if I'm a blind man, first question I'm going to ask somebody if they say, hey, can I help you across the street, is, are you blind? If you're not blind, yeah, I'll be glad for your help. But I'm going to tell you what, if you're blind, you can just move right on. I'll wait for the sound of the ambulance. Then I'll know it's clear across. Well, we need to think about that spiritually. You folks that listen to preaching all the time, you're accountable. And so Jesus is underscoring to the apostles. Turn to Matthew chapter 16 first. And the verse that particularly we're interested in is verse 6. And I'm going to come back and talk about that context in just a moment. Jesus tells them, actually a number of times in their work, to beware the leaven. I'm not going to spend too much time on the idea of beware. I will say this. I think what God wants from us is intentional paranoia. We're kind of uncomfortable with the idea of paranoia, aren't we? What do you think Peter means when he says, be sober and vigilant because the adversary, like a roaring lion, is walking about seeking whom he may devour? If you're walking through the woods and you know there's a lion there, I guarantee you, you're going to be paranoid. Okay, so let's take that and make a healthy application of that. Beware means it's dangerous and you need to be watching. You need to be careful. You are in danger. And the image that he uses is leaven. We don't talk about leaven much, but we're familiar with yeast. My kids will appreciate that. Do you know what yeast is? Yeast is a single-celled organism of the fungus kingdom. So, you know, when your wife makes sourdough bread, you go to Schlotzky's and eat that good sourdough bread, that sourdough bun, or you make yeast rolls, yes, you're eating fungus, okay? And what that fungus does, if you put it in a lump of dough, is that it eats the sugars, the carbohydrates, and it produces, as its waste product, carbon dioxide. And when you get all these little organisms in there, these single-celled organisms, and they're multiplying, they're living, and they're eating, and they're multiplying, and they're living, and they're eating, and they're multiplying, and they're living, and they're eating, they spread. So they can find some more place to eat and multiply. And then they produce gas, and that causes the bread to rise, the dough to rise. Aren't you glad that you came so you can know that? But it's interesting, you know, the Lord created that. And when Jesus uses that image, he's using an image of something that he knows well works in a particular way, a very unusual way, because we can't see it. You put yeast in dough, you can't see it pervade the dough. You can only see the results of it pervading the dough. It's very similar to the way that Jesus uses the illustration of wind in John chapter 3 when he's talking to Nicodemus. You can see the effect of it, but you can't see where it comes from. You can't see where it goes. And that's the way, he says, that the new birth works. And that's the way that leaven works. And so the Creator is using an image to help us to appreciate something that is subtle and unseen and pervasive and has effects that come from it. Now, that's what we're supposed to be wary of. He doesn't say beware the bludgeon. He tells us beware of something that you're not going to see coming. You're not going to appreciate it spread. In fact, you may not know it's there until the effects begin to make themselves known. In Matthew 13, he describes the spread of the kingdom of heaven that way. In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul uses it to describe the wickedness that the church in Corinth was entertaining by not dealing with the adulterous people. In Galatians chapter 5, Paul uses it to describe the spread of the doctrine of Judaism among New Testament Christians. It's silent, it's deadly, it's pervasive, it's going to get in you, and it's going to have an impact upon you. And this is what the caution is for us. Stuff gets in us. Remember our point about the culture of toleration that affects us? Stuff gets in us, folks, and what gets in me grows and develops and processes and spreads, and it begins eventually to show up. And so Jesus' concern in using this image is not so much a concern about some drunkard that tries to pull me out with him to do drugs and drink and go have sexual activity. That's not the thing that's scaring the Lord for his disciples. It's these ideas and thoughts and attitudes that they are seeing around them that may well affect the way they think and eventually affect the way they act. Because how we think determines how we act. I'll tell you, the next time somebody says to you, it doesn't really matter what you believe, as long as you're honest and sincere, you know what you need to tell them? Oh, it does matter what you believe. Because what you believe is what you become. And if you don't believe that, ask somebody who believes that we're nothing more than the product of evolution. That just makes us animals. That means it's okay to act on every urge that we have. Now, it would stand to reason that if I could kill that person couldn't be mad at me and the law couldn't prosecute me. But we're not willing to take it quite that far. But we will apply it to sexual immorality or dishonesty. Hey, I can't help it. It's the way I was created. It's in my genetic makeup. It's just the result of who I am. How we think determines how we act. If I think that there are no gender roles in the family, then there's... the leader is just going to be whoever's got the strongest personality. And there's not going to be a working together, as Michael tried to talk to us about today, where we have an aim to glorify God and bring our children up in the nurture of the admonition of the Lord. We're just going to play it by ear. And if it doesn't work, let's just go get someone else. Why? Because that's how I think. You want to apply it to religion. It would be interesting to me to know how people would read Romans chapter 5 if John Calvin had never published his thinking about grace and about this idea of the sovereignty of God doing everything. Because I really don't believe an honest person who doesn't have that misrepresentation in their head. I don't think they're going to read the Bible and go, well, I don't have to do anything because God's grace saves me, and that's just all there is to it. With all due respect to Brent and the wonderful job he did connecting those cultural concepts to what Paul's saying, you don't need to know those cultural concepts to understand that the grace of God teaches us that we're to deny ourselves. It's all over the Bible. And Brent said that. So we need to beware. In Matthew chapter 16, Jesus and the apostles in verse 5 have just gone across the Sea of Galilee to the region of Magdala, which is on the western shore, which is the part of the Sea of Galilee where Jesus did the vast majority of his works, best we can tell. And as they get to the other side, in verse 5, that says that they'd forgotten to take bread, so Jesus said to them, "Take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees." And they reasoned among themselves, saying, "It's because we've taken no bread." So Jesus, being aware of it, said, oh, you have little faith. Think about that. Don't you trust me? Oh, you have little faith. Why do you reason among yourselves because you brought no bread? Do you not yet understand or remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000, how many baskets you took up? Or the 7 loaves of the 4,000, how many large baskets you took up? How is it that you do not understand that I do not speak to you concerning bread, But beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. In other words, you figure it out. And then they understood that he didn't tell them to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine, the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees. And the parallel accounts in Mark chapter 8, and it's even more interesting because it says the leaven of the Pharisees and of Herod. Now, I think the context here demands a little bit of attention. Because if you back up into the previous chapter, what's just happened is that Jesus has just fed the 4,000 in verse 29. And at this point, please understand if you've studied Matthew, especially Matthew, it's very obvious, Jesus is moving around a lot. Jesus is not hanging around in one part of Galilee or Judea. He's up in the Caesarea Philippi. He's over close to Tyre and Sidon. He's on one side of the Sea of Galilee. He's on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. He's dropping down into Judea. He's up here again. And the reason, as you put all the Gospels together, is the Pharisees everywhere are out to get him at this point. And so is Herod. This is after Herod has killed John the Baptist. And that whole thing arises when Herod hears about the miracles of Jesus. And he's certain that it's John the Baptist risen from the dead. If I was a ruler and had killed somebody and thought they rose from the dead, I'd be out to get them too. And you have to appreciate the apostles have to be aware of all these things. Here we are here we are there. They go across the Sea of Galilee in verse 29. They skirted. Jesus goes up on a mountain and all these multitudes. Every time he shows up someplace, just a big crowd shows up. And so Jesus will teach them and Jesus is healing them in verse 31. And they're there for 3 days and they didn't bring food to eat. So Jesus feeds them, 4,000 men, 7 loaves and a few fish. And he sends them away, and they get on a boat, and they go back across the Sea of Galilee. And what you find in the first few verses of chapter 16 is the Pharisees and the Sadducees are waiting for him. When he comes into that region, they show up, and the first thing that they say is, "We'd like to see a sign from heaven." The Pharisees and Sadducees attack Jesus repeatedly with two things, best I can see. If he casts out a demon, he did it by the power of Beelzebub, and why don't you show us a sign from heaven? Now, he's just fed 4,000 people with a few loaves and fishes. But on this occasion, Jesus says, you know, when it's evening, you say that it'll be fair weather, the sky's red, and in the morning, it's going to be foul weather because the sky's red and threatening. You're a bunch of hypocrites. You're a bunch of hypocrites because you know how to discern the face of the sky, but you can't discern the signs of the times. The Old Testament prophesied that the Messiah was going to do all the stuff Jesus was going to do. When John the Baptist sends his disciples, "Are you the Messiah?" Jesus just tells them, "Go tell them what I'm doing. You connect the dots, John. It's obvious who I am." And the Pharisees could see that. So Jesus says, you know, it's just a wicked and adulterous generation that seeks a sign, and the only sign you're going to get is the sign of the prophet Jonah. And then they leave. And they're going across. And don't you know the apostles are going, "Oh, man, I tell you what. I wonder if the Pharisees are going to show up this time on the other side of the sea." And sooner or later, one of these groups of Pharisees, they're not going to take this scathing rebuke. We're going to be in trouble. And so Jesus is going along and says, "Hey, guys. Hey, you need to watch out for the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees." And I'm sure one of them goes, "Man, he figured out that we didn't bring anything to eat." And don't you know Jesus is over there shaking his head going, "Come on, guys. Are you not getting it yet?" What he tells them in this occasion is, these guys are teaching things that are going to impact you. Now, that's interesting to me because in Matthew chapter 23, Jesus says the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, and whatever they tell you to do, do. Just don't follow their example. So I'm not sure that Jesus is pointing necessarily to their doctrine as much as he is to the fact that when they approached Jesus' authority, they did so dishonestly. They wouldn't look at the signs. They wouldn't be honest with what Jesus was saying and doing. They wouldn't properly apply the Old Testament prophecies. Jesus called them on it about the baptism of John the Baptist. Was it from heaven or was it from men? And in Matthew 21, their response is, "Well, if we say this, the people are going to be mad. And if we say this, he's going to ask us why we didn't obey him. So we're just not going to answer the question." They are dishonest. These are the religious authorities. These are the guys these young disciples had grown up listening to in the synagogues. These are our teachers. They are Brother Bowman Okay? Get that. And they're educated men, and they're powerful men, and they are experienced men, and they're probably older men. Maybe they had published some of their writings, and you could go down to the local synagogue and find a scroll written by some guy up here that's of some other synagogue, and wow, I got to meet Gamaliel this week. That's who Jesus is warning them about. And what he says about them is they're wicked and adulterous, and what they're going to teach you is doubt and dishonesty and temporality and selfishness, because that's the way they think. So how do we apply that? Well, who do you allow to influence your thinking? Who are the people other than God that you listen to? Who influences you? As preachers, are we influenced by the culture around us and the idea of there are certain things that I'm not going to preach because they're hard and people aren't going to listen to them. And what we'll do is we'll teach the basics of the gospel, we'll get them converted, then we'll work on the repentance stuff. Do you compromise in the way that you approach the teaching of the gospel? Do you try to teach things that are palatable or make hard things palatable? Do you teach holiness as God promotes it? Or do you just kind of hope that we'll teach the fundamentals and those things will come along at some point? I tell you what, I see driving some guys in our day and age, and I hope I don't offend anybody, but if I do, maybe you need to hear it. I see some of our brethren that are really impressed with academia and intellectualism. And if we're going to publish an article, man, we need to make it sound big and complicated and academic, and we need to footnote it right and left. And I'm going to tell you, there's good places. David Curry's dad is one of my heroes. And he has a PhD, and he is a brilliant man, and he's written a lot of good stuff, and I have derived great benefit from it. But I'm going to tell you something, folks, preachers. The gospel's pretty simple. And we don't have to footnote Farrell Jenkins or Buddy Payne or Dee Bowman or Brent Moody or Melvin Curry in order to convince somebody of what they need to do to serve the Lord. And that scares me, because we're taking what is a simple proposition. We messed up, God fixed it. That's the gospel. That is the redeeming love David talked about. And we try so hard to make it more than it is. Why do we do that? Well, we do it because we live in a world that is impressed with intellectualism. Go back, ask some of these older guys. Go back and look at part of what drove the institutional divisions in the 50s and the 40s after World War II. Part of it was we want to be seen as educated men. We need to send our guys off to the colleges. We need to make sure that they come back learning. We don't need a bunch of farm boys out preaching the gospel. Nobody's going to listen to them. People are educated now. Maybe we need a few more farm boys teaching the gospel. Because those kinds of things affect the way we think and the way that we do our work. And so I ask you, where are you getting your ideas? Who are you reading? Who are you concerned about? Where do your concepts come from? I said a minute ago, and I believe it, I do not believe you would come up with the Calvinistic view of grace if you just read the gospel, you just read the Bible through an unprejudiced filter. And the same thing has to do with quote-unquote Church of Christ doctrine. And that's a challenge for gospel preachers, because we do derive benefit from sources other than, and we do get good ideas and better understandings from the things that we read, but we need to be careful to distinguish between what some guy says and what the book says. And we need to be careful about where we're getting our concepts. And I tell you, cultural influences affect us as well. You know, are you preaching so that you can make sure that the church where you are is really big? I guarantee you, if that's your goal, you're going to make some compromises. You will make some compromises if numbers is all you're worried about. It's going to happen. Mark my words. Are you being driven by fame? you know, this week, man, you'd think that these 15 guys that worked under D. Bowman were pretty special and that D. Bowman was really special. Well, one of the things he taught us is, no, none of us are special. We are unprofitable servants. You remember those lessons? We don't need selfies of every place we're going to a gospel meeting. Hey, I'm over here. Come see me. No, we're not out to... That's what the culture around us is influencing us to think. We just need to go do our work. Whenever we're asked to do it, wherever we're asked to do it, with no fanfare, not worrying about the money, not worrying about who's in charge, not worrying about social media, not worrying about it. And we need to work. We're not doing this because it's an easy way to make a living. All of those are influences of culture, and the way that we think is affected. Turn over to Luke chapter 12. There's one other time that Jesus uses this image. And there are some parallels here, but they are different incidents. If you look at the context, that becomes very clear. In Luke chapter 12, once again, actually in the first verse, in the meantime, when an innumerable multitude of people had gathered together, so they've trampled one another, he began to say to his disciples, first of all, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. Only this time he doesn't say it's doctrine, it's hypocrisy. We get this when the Pharisees are involved, and the context here makes it very clear why Jesus says this. If you back up into the previous chapter, once again, there has been some conflict with the Pharisees all the way back in chapter 17 over the casting out of a demon, and a crowd begins to gather, and a woman praises him for his work, and he starts talking to them about keeping the word of God, and this being an evil generation, and the men of Nineveh and the men of Sodom rising up in judgment. And in the middle of this, a Pharisee says, hey, it's getting close to supper time. Would you come eat at my house? And so Jesus does. And when he gets there, and they're all sitting around making small talk, Jesus says, hey, you Pharisees, you're a bunch of hypocrites. Can you imagine? Hey, come over and eat with me. Sure, you are the biggest hypocrite. That's what he does. Look at verse 39. You Pharisees make the outside of the cup and the dish clean. Inward, you're full of wickedness. You're fools. Didn't he make the outside and the inside? And so he pretty much scathes them. Woe to you, Pharisees. And then one of the lawyers is sitting there going, hey, wait a minute. If you're saying that about them, then we stand condemned too. And Jesus says, yes, you do. And so Jesus talks to the lawyers. Woe to you also. You load men with burdens hard to bear and don't touch one of the burdens with your fingers. And by the time this meal is over in verse 53, the scribes and the Pharisees begin to assail him vehemently and cross-examine him about many things, lying in wait, seeking to catch him in something to say that they might accuse him, and they're doing it in front of a crowd. Because the very next verse says, in the meantime, an innumerable multitude of people have gathered together. So they're all around this house, and they're listening to all of this. And Jesus turns to his disciples and says, you better watch out for the influence of these guys right here and their hypocrisy. These were their religious leaders. I don't know how much they recognized the hypocrisy of the Pharisees, but it was a problem that the God's people have always dealt with. All the way back in the prophets, God's constantly criticizing the people about making sacrifices, and it's not affecting their character. There is the danger of externality and with no true holiness, and Jesus is worried about that in his apostles, and he's worried about that in us too, folks, because we live in a culture of religiosity. 98% of the people in this country, according to the last Gallup poll, believe in God. Do you realize that? 10% of the atheists in this country pray. I don't get that. But we're a religious people, a spiritual people. 70-something percent say that it's still important to them to be involved in some kind of religious activity. And yet, culture's just... What is it that Bennett said, slouching toward Gomorrah? And that affects us. Jesus says in verse 1, he says to his disciples, first of all, Now, what that means is this admonition is not just for the apostles. This is for everybody. And I want you to understand something. Listen very carefully because I need to wrap this up. We are all potential hypocrites. Every person in here who's named the name of Christ is a potential hypocrite. You want to know why? Because we're all trying to be godly and we all have our problems. And the difference between a hypocrite and everybody else is that real disciples who have problems, we're struggling with them. We have our weaknesses, we have our battles. Dad stood on the front porch when I was 20 years old going through the preacher training program and told me, and I quote, "You'll never make a preacher because you're too selfish." And he was right. And I fight it every day of my life. And I fight my frustrations, and I fight my cynicism, and I fight my temper, and I fight my impatience. I fight my pride, I fight my lust. Every day is a fight. Every day is a fight. And I'm going to tell you what. When we quit fighting and we keep acting like we're serving the Lord and we just give in to the battle, then we're hypocrites. And we need to look carefully. Is my religion covering my immorality? Is my religion covering my ego? Is my religion helping it so that people don't see my greed and my covetousness? Is my religion, is my preaching covering my self-righteousness and my cynicism? Is my religion covering my doubt? I don't want anybody else to know. I'll act like everything's hunky-dory with the Lord and I'll go live however I want to. You better beware of the leaven, because everybody around us in this society is doing that. We need to be honest and we need to be humble and we need to be penitent, folks, because Jesus is talking to us. Interesting thing about the end of this is that as you go on in chapter 12, the next thing Jesus says in verse 2 is, "There's nothing covered that won't be revealed, nothing hidden that won't be known. Whatever is spoken in the dark will be heard in the light, and whatever is spoken in the ear and inner rooms will be proclaimed in the housetops. And I say to you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body and after that have no more they can do. I'll show you whom you should fear. Fear him who after he is killed has power to cast into hell. Yes, I say to you, fear him. Are not 5 sparrows sold for 2 copper coins? Not one of them is forgotten before God. The very hairs of your head are all numbered. Do not fear, therefore. You're of more value than many sparrows. If you confess me before men, I'll confess you before God." The problem with leaven is that we pay too much attention to the culture around us, and it impacts us. And we quit being afraid of what everybody around us says because we know we're going to be distinct. And all we're concerned about is what God says, then we will stand up and confess our Lord. And the conflict's going to come. And we're going to stand. And on the day of judgment, the Lord's going to reward us. Not because we were perfect, but because we paid attention to the warning. Please, beware the leaven. Thank you so much.